So the appetite for this kind of transformative project is enormous. And we see all of this as more signs that although establishment politicians fear change, a great many people are hungry for it. We understand that we've gone so far off course and time is so short that we now have to go for it on all fronts. At this late hour, with so much to lose and with so much to gain, now is not the time for small steps. Now is the time for boldness. Now is the time to leap. Thank you.
That's Naomi Klein, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Naomi Klein on the radical leap. Political organizers are aware of wedge issues that divide us and web issues that bring us together. What could be more unifying than saving the planet? The Earth is heating up. Polar ice caps are melting. Sea levels are rising. April was the 12th consecutive hottest month on record. The December 2015 Paris Climate Change Agreement doesn't rise to the challenge. Clearly, it's going to take mobilization from below to radically change the fossilized attitudes of the fossil fuel industry and the politicians that they bankroll. Broad coalitions of diverse groups seek to do just that. Climate activism engages a new intersectional politics. From Pope Francis to the Dalai Lama, workers and trade unionists, indigenous peoples, and many others are speaking with one voice on the issue like never before. Momentum is building. To talk about the radical leap toward a green and sustainable future is Naomi Klein. She's from Canada, an award-winning journalist, author, and filmmaker. She's in the forefront of environmental activism. Her articles appear in major newspapers and magazines all over the world. She's the author of the bestseller, This Changes Everything. She spoke at the University of Colorado in Boulder. And now, Naomi Klein.
I am here to talk about the crisis of climate change. And some of you may be thinking that's silly because our politicians fixed that in December in Paris at the big UN climate convention. Even our media, usually so cynical, right, just couldn't help getting in on the euphoria. Look at some of these headlines reporting on what happened in Paris. My favorite one, that the deal marks the end of the fossil fuel age. And I actually saw this headline in quite a few publications, including some I really respect. And I'm sure you've all noticed, right? The gas stations closing in droves, right? And, you know, a few weeks ago, Exxon came out with this report communicating to the market what they saw as their medium to long-term prospects. And it was a very reassuring document. They wanted investors to know that they didn't see what happened in Paris as any kind of threat to them. They said that they believed that the share of the energy market taken up by oil and gas would continue to grow to mid-century, which is strange because if we are going to do the things that our politicians said they were going to do in Paris, we actually need to be off fossil fuels by mid-century, not continuing to grow that market. So what is going on? Was what happened in Paris the political diplomatic breakthrough we were all told, or was it an ecological disaster? And the short answer, actually, is both. That, in fact, what our leaders negotiated in Paris is the best they've managed so far. It was indeed a breakthrough, and it is still a catastrophe from a scientific perspective. And that's because we have waited so long to treat this crisis seriously that the things we need to do are really quite radical. Because we now face this choice between a radically changed physical world or changing our political and economic system in some pretty radical ways. I want to unpack a little bit more of what happened in Paris, because this is a deal we are going to be living with, and because, as you see, the reporting has been a little bit less than reliable. So what happened, okay? Here's what's good that I think really is genuinely significant. Our leaders set some pretty ambitious goals about keeping warming below a certain level, right? So there were huge fights about this, about what temperature target to set. And the deal ended up saying that governments are pledging to keep temperatures below 2 degrees Celsius of warming before we started burning fossil fuels on an industrial scale, but actually to try to keep it even lower than that, to make best efforts to limit the temperature increase to 1.5 degrees Celsius. So that distinction between 1.5 and 2 degrees really matters. It was a huge fight to get 1.5 in the agreement, because the slogan for low-lying island nations in these negotiations has been 1.5 to survive. That, there's no guarantee that a nation like Tuvalu or the Maldives wouldn't disappear beneath the waves, even with 1.5 warming. But 2 degrees, it's over, right? And I was in Copenhagen in 2009, the last time there was one of these massive UN summits with all the world leaders there. And at that summit, the temperature target was set at 2 degrees. And when news of this came out in the convention floor, the African delegates had an impromptu demonstration. Hundreds of people left the sessions they were in and marched through the halls of the convention center, calling it genocide. Because in Africa, that 2 degrees would translate to 3 to 3.5 degrees. So, you know, this matters. This is really about whether Black lives matter. This is a moral crisis, it's an ethical crisis, and that we did get 1.5 into the text matters, and that's why a lot of people were cheering. But here's the bad news. The same governments that set these goals simultaneously declared themselves unwilling to do the things necessary to achieve them. Now, this takes a little explaining about how the UN works. If you're going to set a target of 1.5 or 2 degrees and you're serious about it, one approach that many were advocating for would have been to say, okay, well, we've got all kinds of great climate modeling and we know what our carbon budget is, if we're serious about that, to give ourselves a good chance of meeting that. We can divide up that target based on equity, based on the principles already agreed upon in the UN Convention on Climate Change. So the US would get a certain slice of that pie, and China would get a certain slice of that pie, and Bangladesh would get a certain slice. So this approach was deemed overly top-down. We don't want to tell countries what to do anymore, right? It had to be this voluntary approach. And so what happened is that governments were told, go and do the best you can come up with a nationally determined plan for how much you can cut your emissions by and bring those commitments, those plans, to Paris. And fingers crossed, we hope that that will add up to our goal of keeping warming below 2 to 1.5 degrees. The problem is, if you add up all the national plans, they add up to warming of 3 to 4 degrees, okay? So what we have in Paris is a pretty good definition of safety coupled with a concrete plan for disaster. What our governments did was they said, we know what we need to do and we are willing to do roughly half that. But don't worry, there is a plan in the Paris Accord for how to bridge this gap, which is acknowledged in the accord, bizarrely enough. And that plan is that they agree to meet every 5 years, take stock, and hope that things have changed for the better. It's actually a little bit worse than that. And the reason it's worse is that the plans that all of these governments brought to the table in Paris are not legally binding. The Obama administration said before the negotiations started that they could not sign anything that was a legally binding treaty because they would not be able to bring it back to the U.S. Congress for the reasons we all understand, that the U.S. Congress is controlled by Republicans who are bought and paid for by the fossil fuel lobby and a lot of Democrats as well. So these are non-binding pledges, and that's why Republican candidates are now campaigning to break the promises that the Obama administration made in Paris. That's why your Supreme Court is also treating this as a joke and has basically frozen the centerpiece of Obama's plan, which is the clean energy power plan, the clean power plan. Canada, by the way, is also set to break the paltry targets that we brought to Paris. So if we stay on the road we're actually on, which is in all the climate modeling often referred to as business as usual, in other words, if we just keep on the road we're on and don't introduce any kind of serious emission reduction, it doesn't lead to 2 degrees warming or 1.5 or even 3 to 4, which is what the current plans lead to. It leads to 6 degrees, according to the International Energy Agency. We have so far warmed the planet by about 1 degree Celsius. What does this mean? So we have to always remember that climate change plays out very differently in different parts of this country. It plays out very differently even within colder parts of the country, depending on your socioeconomic situation. And obviously, it plays out very differently in different parts of the world. This past summer, India and Pakistan suffered a historic heat wave. Thousands of people died. And in Karachi, morgues ran out of space. You know, in Colorado, you have seen the more catastrophic side of extreme weather. You're dealing with wildfires, you're dealing with pine beetle outbreaks, and of course, the record-shattering flooding that hit Boulder County so hard in 2013. You know, if this is what 1 degree looks like, and we are headed towards 6 degrees, and this is not a deal that is going to protect us in any meaningful way. This is why not everybody was cheering in Paris. It's why on the last day of the summit, there was a demonstration where people unfurled these huge red lines through the streets of Paris. And, you know, what was significant about this demonstration, thousands of people took to the streets, was that Paris was hit by these devastating terrorist attacks just 2 weeks before the summit started. And so protests were banned for the entire time. And this is part of the reason why this very rosy picture of what happened was able to blast out from the summit fairly unimpeded, because we weren't allowed to demonstrate. And you know, there were a few sort of impromptu demonstrations, but for the most part, that sort of public dissent, there would have been 1 million people on the streets of Paris had it not been canceled. By the end, people were so determined to not let the leaders have the last word that they took to the streets anyway in these red lines demonstrations. And the red lines are signifying that this deal crosses scientific red lines, legal red lines, ethical, humanitarian red lines, equity red lines, and so on. So I was in the streets that day, and the mood was not one of despair or defeatism. It was really, more than anything, it was one of clarity. Like, okay, our leaders have said what needs to happen. They've made it very clear they're not going to do it. So it is up to social movements to change the political dynamics so that we hold them to those promises. And that's why we were there. And we are. We are going to hold them to 1.5. And there are all kinds of amazing things happening around the world and in your backyard that I hope you'll plug into, to declare that people's crisis that you already heard spoke about. Our governments are not the only ones with the power to declare this an emergency. But before I go there, I want to talk a little bit more about why we find ourselves in this moment of such high contradiction, where there is such a huge gap between what our leaders say about this crisis and what actually gets done. Right? And we often hear these theories that it's human nature, we're just greedy, and I believe it's something more systemic that is standing in our way. So, what does climate change look like within this system? 4 years into a devastating drought in California, the wildfire season doesn't end. They hoped that they were finally getting out of it because of El Nino. LA was under fire warning in February, right? They are not out of drought. So this work, you know, the people who are fighting the fires are doing some of the most dangerous work in our society, and they really should be seen as our climate change first responders. And I think you guys know how dangerous this work is. There have been firefighters who have lost their lives doing this work. Those firefighters are prison inmates with the Department of Corrections in California, and that is a big portion of who is fighting fires. And you actually have a similar program here in Colorado. It's not as extensive as California's, but you got it. California, it's really extensive. So there are 10,000 firefighters who work for Cal Fire, and 4,000 of them are prison inmates. They work in these fire camps, and they get paid $2 a day. And when they are actively fighting the fires, and they're brought in to do the most dangerous work, and they're very open that they're doing the most dangerous work because they're not the ones who are coming in, you know, in these sort of armored vehicles or fighting fires from the air. They are going in with their bodies with no protection to clear the way for those vehicles. Okay, so they're doing the most dangerous work. And when they are in there actively fighting fires, they're paid $1 an hour. So this is happening for the obvious reasons. It saves the state of California an estimated $1 billion a year. And California, like many states, is in perpetual budget crisis, and they also have made it virtually impossible to raise taxes. Here's the really incredible part. The state is in this direct conflict of interest because California has some of the most criminally overcrowded prisons in the world. And the courts have ordered the state of California to do something about prison overcrowding. And what they need to do is they need to release their low-risk offenders, right? But the low-risk offenders are the ones who are eligible to participate in the FIRE program. So the state has actually argued in court that they cannot comply with these orders to release low-risk offenders because it would put their state firefighting program at risk. It's become trendy on college campuses to talk about intersectional politics, and some people have been quite snide about this, but I want to speak up for intersectional politics. We have to get out of our silos and see how climate change, racism, austerity, mass incarceration, economic inequality are all interconnected. And as we go down this road we're on, each one of these crises gets worse. So how did we end up at this place where it seems so difficult to respond to this collective crisis? I believe that one of the things that explains it best, and no explanation is going to be all-encompassing, but one of the things that I think explains it best and that we have not discussed nearly enough is just that climate change has had this epic case of bad timing, of historical bad timing. And by that I mean that it landed on our laps at the worst possible moment in human evolution, and that was the 80s. Remember, maybe the most famous living climate scientist, a young, fresh-faced James Hansen testifying before Congress in 1988. And, you know, all the climate geeks in the room know the importance of this date. This is when James Hansen testified on Capitol Hill that he could now say with a high degree of certainty that climate change was happening and that humans were causing it. So I want to be clear, 1988 is not when climate scientists figured out that this was true. It is not when U.S. presidents first started hearing about it. That was decades earlier. This was when the public really got involved in this issue, when this became a public policy issue. And there was a huge amount of momentum fed by Dr. Hansen's testimony. You know, this was front page news for days, and this led to all kinds of action. 1988 was the first year that governments got together to start talking about how we are going to lower our emissions. It was the first intergovernmental meeting on climate change. It was the year that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change was formed. And just to give you a sense of how much this was not just about wonky stuff, but about regular people saying, we need to do something about this, let's fix this, when the editors of Time magazine needed to choose their man of the year in 1988, and it was only men, so don't, you know, look at me like that. This was 1988. They made this very bold decision. They chose the planet as their man of the year. So, I mean, that was the mood, okay? We get it. We're in trouble. We need to do something about this. So what got in the way? What interrupted the signal? Why didn't we, okay, with all of this goodwill and resolve? So what else was happening in 1988? 1988 was the year that Canada and the U.S. signed the first major free trade deal that was eventually extended into the North American Free Trade Agreement and became the prototype for similar corporate free trade deals around the world. This was going to happen the next year, the Berlin Wall collapsing. Good news in and of itself. But the way the collapse of the Berlin Wall was interpreted by neocons in Washington was that this meant, in the words of Francis Fukuyama, that history had ended, and that this now meant that there was no barrier, and the fall of the wall came to symbolize that, there was no barrier to export the kind of market fundamentalism, as Joseph Stiglitz calls it, that had come to dominate in the U.S. under Reagan and in the U.K. under Thatcher, could now be exported to every corner of the globe, including former Soviet states and all over the global South using structural adjustment policies. There were many names for this project. The Washington Consensus in most parts of the world is called neoliberalism. So there is a role for government in this worldview, and that role is to create the optimal conditions for private interests to maximize their profits and wealth based on the theory that the economic growth that would ensue would benefit everybody eventually in the trickle down. So the primary tools of this new order were rapid-fire privatization of the public sphere, rapid-fire deregulation of the corporate sphere, low corporate taxes paid for by cuts to social services, all locked in under corporate-friendly trade deals. And because of the disenfranchisement that came with these policies, it has also been consistently accompanied by policies of criminalization and mass incarceration and militarization of borders to keep people out. So this is familiar stuff. This is the air we breathe. This is for the young people in the audience or just the people under 40, all we've ever known, right? So what does it have to do with climate change? And, you know, it may seem unrelated. And I was really struck when I was reading up on climate change as somebody who didn't, you know all that much about it when I started this journey a decade ago. There was very little literature about how the neoliberal policies stand in the way and indeed clash with what we need to do in the face of this crisis at every turn, right? So I want to very quickly run down the clash, right? So privatization of the public sphere, deregulation, keeping taxes low, corporate free trade deals, right? If we're going to take climate change seriously, rather than scale back our investments in the public sphere, we need massive investments in the public sphere. This is blindingly obvious, right? We need to invest in the public sphere just to deal with the heavy weather we've already locked in, but we also need to invest in it because we need to transform our energy systems. We need to completely reimagine how we move ourselves around. We need to transform our transit systems, invest in public transit, invest in light rail. This is obvious, but it runs counter to the ideological project we've all been living with. We need to regulate corporations. Yeah. We need to say no to them, right? I mean, not, you know, create free market solutions and new trading markets and win-wins. We actually need to say to the fossil fuel companies that have five times more carbon in their proven reserves than is compatible with 2 degrees, no, you can't dig that up, right? And we were living, have been living in a time where it's been very difficult for politicians to say no to corporations. Now, this transformation of our public sphere is costly. And we need money for it. And that means that we need to raise taxes. It would make sense to raise taxes on the people who are polluting the most. And as I said, we've been living in a time when just saying taxes can get you in all kinds of trouble. We need to localize our economies, where we manufacture and grow our food so that we're less reliant on fossil fuels. And yet we were locking in these trade agreements that were all about lengthening the supply chains. So we have these clashes at every level. And privatization, which was so central to the neoliberal project, I mean, we weren't just privatizing the public sphere, we were privatizing those very parts of the public sphere that we needed to control most, privatizing our rail systems, privatizing our energy systems, you know, our airlines. How much easier would this transition have been if we had maintained some level of control? And here in Boulder, and this is why it has a special place in This Changes Everything, I think you guys understand this clash between putting such essential services like energy in the hands of corporations who are driven exclusively by the profit motive, how that clashes with the need to transform those systems. Because when a group of young environmental activists decided a few years ago that they thought this city, which is known around the world for being very, very green and very, very crunchy, maybe shouldn't get its energy from fossil fuels and should shift rapidly to renewables, they discovered pretty quickly that your corporate utility, Xcel, wasn't all that interested in a rapid transition to renewables. So let's hear it for your local energy project. So these young activists began a remarkable and frankly historic campaign to regain power over your energy grid. And you know what struck me most when I found out about this is that it was entirely for non-ideological reasons, right? It wasn't like this group of young people was like, we're against energy privatization on principle. No, they wanted your utility to do this. It was just that they weren't willing to do it. And so then the idea came to take back power. And you know this story. It's your story. Two referendums later, you're well on your way to creating a public utility that would prioritize the green energy transition. Now, you wouldn't know this from the headlines. And that's because Excel is working overtime, spending all kinds of money to undermine the process. And this is not just a Boulder phenomenon. We're seeing across the country that coal-fired public utilities, many of them owned by Warren Buffett, are waging a war on solar, particularly decentralized rooftop solar, because they don't want their customers to be their competitors. And this is happening in Nevada, it's happening in Florida, it's happening in the sunniest states, and people are really fighting back. But I think the kind of resistance that you're experiencing here in Boulder is because it isn't just about the switch. It is about energy democracy. It is about reversing privatization. And there are a lot of powerful interests, and not just this one company, that don't want your city to be a model for another path. So understand that even though there seem to be setbacks and even though it's a tough road, this is worth fighting, and all eyes are on you. So thank you for your work. So that's the one of the ways in which one of the planks of the neoliberal project is standing in the way of where we need to go. Another is the ethos of deregulation. And when every once in a while you will have a win, and after many years of pressure, 4 years, finally Obama says no to the Keystone XL pipeline. And an incredible movement victory. I was arrested protesting Keystone, and I was very proud that I was arrested alongside Jason Box, one of Colorado's great climate scientists. He's now in Copenhagen. And yet the story is not over, because now TransCanada, the Canadian company that wanted to build that pipeline, is suing the U.S. government using the investor rights provision in the North American Free Trade Agreement, in NAFTA, suing the U.S. for $15 billion in the profits it claims it would have made if it had been allowed to build that pipeline. So this is another clash we have with all of these trade deals, with the rules of the World Trade Organization. We have another example of this. India has some pretty impressive supports for its solar industry to encourage production of solar technologies in India to create jobs. And American solar companies didn't like this, proving that just because you work in renewable energy doesn't necessarily mean that you are working for the greater good. They didn't like that India supported their renewable sector. They wanted access to those markets. So they asked the U.S. government to challenge India's supports for renewables at the World Trade Organization. And the World Trade Organization ruled against India. Okay, so this is insane. We are living in a world upside down where countries that are doing the right thing are getting penalized, and where instead of getting the polluters to pay for the transition off of fossil fuels, we are supposed to pay the polluters when our governments finally do the right thing. So this is why we need a very different trading system. We need to reopen these agreements, and we need to renegotiate them, and we certainly cannot be signing new ones like the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which has not yet been ratified. Not yet been ratified, but if it is, tens of thousands of new firms and their subsidiaries would be able to directly sue governments for the first time under the TPP for exactly the kind of bogus claim that TransCanada is trying now. So that this can happen raises the elephant in the room, which is the power of money over politics, particularly in this country.
You're listening to Naomi Klein, The Radical Leap. This is Alternative Radio. You can order copies of this program by calling 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
So, I've been talking about a clash between neoliberalism and climate action, but this isn't just about neoliberalism, right? Because we have waited so long, and we have made the problem so much worse, because as we've been talking about doing something about climate change, we've actually increased emissions by 60% in the past 2.5 decades since our government started meeting about lowering emissions. And so when that happens, the things you need to do change, right? If we had started in 1988 or 1992 when the UN Convention was signed, cutting emissions, then we could have done it gradually. But we didn't, right? So now we need to cut deep. If we want to stay within a 2-degree carbon budget, let alone 1.5, Countries like the United States have to be cutting their emissions by 10% a year. This is according to the Tyndall Center on Climate Change Research and Kevin Anderson's work there. This is a leading research institute on emission reductions and climate research. There's not an economist on earth who will tell you that it is possible to reconcile 10% annual emission reductions with an economic system built to pursue economic growth at all costs. And that's why we have a conflict not just between neoliberalism and climate action, but between capitalism and climate action. That doesn't mean that there's no role for markets. There are. But, you know, I get in trouble from some of my friends in the environmental movement who say, you know, like, climate change was a big enough problem. Did you have to make it about capitalism? And, you know, I get it. But here's the thing. Like, that system is failing the vast majority of people on this planet with or without climate change. And people know it. And they're organizing. And they're responding. And we are in a moment where of historic organizing in this country with the rise of movements like Fight for 15 and Black Lives Matter. These are very different movements, of course, but there are threads of connection. People are refusing to be treated as if they are disposable, whether by their employer at a fast food restaurant or by the police. People are hitting their limits of how much abuse they can take, just as our planet is hitting the limit of how much abuse it can take. And this same limit hitting is also why I think an avowed democratic socialist is having such an impact in this election cycle. And I think it's also why a Pope who sounds a lot like him is making waves around the world. There's a certain similarity between these 70-somethings. Who would have thought these would be the rock stars of 2016? You know, and this is happening because the promise at the heart of the neoliberal project, right, was that if we create conditions for the wealthiest to do the best, it will trickle down for everybody else. But people are seeing that that promise at the heart of this whole project is a lie. They're seeing it in their daily lives, and now we have lots and lots of data from Thomas Piketty to back it up. We know that, in fact, this has led to widening inequality, massive dispossession. So it is that trickle down is failing. And I think that this is part of a deeper crisis. I think climate change deserves to be understood not just as a political and economic crisis, but as a crisis of narrative, of worldview, a spiritual crisis, a crisis of apartness, right? Of a story we've been telling ourselves for a long time, not everybody on this planet, a story that came from a very specific place, came from Europe, that came from thinkers like René Descartes, who said that man could be masters and possessors of nature, which was a crazy idea for most people on this planet and still is, right? I mean, most cultures have a healthy reverence and a healthy dose of fear when it comes to nature, right? But the thing about fossil fuels is when we started burning them on an industrial scale, they seemed to give this claim of mastery some substance, right? We really did seem to be able to call the shots, human beings, when we started burning fossil fuels on this scale. Ships could sail in any weather. You didn't have to wait for the wind to blow. You could build a factory wherever you wanted. You could move it wherever labor was cheapest. You didn't, you know, factories used to have to be built next to rapids and rushing water to power. So fossil fuels allowed us to tell ourselves that we could have this one-way dominance-based relationship with nature and also with people, because this was always intimately connected with the politics of colonialism, extraction, with that drive to find the most exploitable workforce. Andreas Malm, a Swedish historian of the coal industry, calls climate change the atmospheric legacy of a class war. Because all this time that we were telling ourselves that we were in charge, that we were the boss of nature, its masters and possessors, that we were having this one-way relationship, we were burning fossil fuels, and the CO2 was accumulating, the gases were accumulating relentlessly and trapping heat, and now comes the response, and the response says, you think you're the boss? Think again. So this is a narrative crisis, and people are responding, refusing to be thrown away, refusing to be treated like garbage. The Pope talks about the throwaway culture, the culture that would throw refugees away, allowing them to disappear beneath the waves. And indeed, that same logic is what allows our politicians to think that they can throw away entire countries and allow them to disappear beneath the waves. This is an ethical crisis. So people are defending their land, their communities, and doing what politicians have refused to do, which is stand up to the power of the fossil fuel companies. Some people call this blockadia. It's a movement that's a lot older than the fight against the Keystone XL pipeline, but that phrase comes from that fight. This spirit of blockadia is surrounding every major fossil fuel project, wherever it is being built. And this is part of a strategy where we understand that these big infrastructure projects, right, whether it's a tar sands pipeline, whether it's a liquid natural gas terminal, these projects are built to last, right? So we're not just talking about the emissions this year and next year. You don't invest billions of dollars in a new infrastructure project if you are not intending to reap profits for 30 or 40 years, past the point that we need to be off fossil fuels. So that's why we have to prevent this infrastructure lock-in. More and more of these blockadia fights are winning, and that's because they're awesome, and it's also because of the price of oil. Went from $100 a barrel to $30 a barrel in a period of 18 months, a true market shock. So what's happening here is that we have been living in the era of extreme energy, right? The easy stuff is gone, and that's why we're seeing more deep water technology, Arctic drilling, tar sands, the mining of the semi-solid crud in northern Alberta. It only made sense to mine the Alberta tar sands when the price of oil past $100 a barrel. Before that, much of the Alberta tar sands wasn't even counted as part of the fossil fuel reserves. This is not because we didn't know it was there. Indigenous people in northern Alberta used bitumen, that tarry stuff, to weatherize their canoes. We've known it was there. It just didn't make economic sense to dig it up. And so what's happening is now fossil fuel companies find themselves in this pincer of more and more resistance to the infrastructure projects and dropping profitability for these extreme energy projects. And this is leading to a lot of these projects being put on ice or canceled altogether. I think it probably had something to do with Shell's decision to pull out. It's why tens of billions worth of projects have been canceled in the Alberta tar sands. The other factor that's really having an impact is fossil fuel divestment, okay? In 2 years, we've seen an exponential growth. We now have 500 institutions with assets worth $3.4 trillion that have committed to divest. This includes universities, cities, towns, churches, and foundations. So this divestment movement is building on divestment movements of the past, including the anti-apartheid movement, which was the first protest I ever participated in, was an occupation of my university president's office to divest from companies invested in South Africa. And I think I have a very skewed vision of the power of activism, because a week later apartheid ended, so it seemed really, it was like, this is easy. Anyway. Harder than that. So the other precedent that is being drawn on here is divestment from tobacco companies, right? A lot of public interest institutions, research institutions, universities divested from tobacco stocks in the 1990s. And this was not just because they realized that smoking causes cancer. They already knew that. The reason why there was a lot of momentum around tobacco divestment was because what we discovered was that the tobacco companies knew about the link between smoking and cancer, did all kinds of research on it, buried the research, and lied to the public, and funded campaigns of disinformation, selling doubt. Doubt is our product, and so on. So one of the things that's changing in the fossil fuel divestment movement is that the parallel between the tobacco precedent and the fossil fuel reality today is getting stronger day by day. And that is because of what we have been finding out about Exxon and their friends. So what we now know, thanks to fantastic investigative research from Inside Climate News, LA Times, Columbia School of Journalism, who've just been digging through troves of documents, is that Exxon has been conducting cutting-edge research on the reality of climate change going back to the 1970s, okay? Well before James Hansen testified before Congress. And they were using their own oil tankers to take CO2 measurements from the ocean and air, and they were publishing their findings that this is happening, that climate change is happening, we are having this impact, in peer-reviewed journals. And the other thing that's come out in the documents is that the company was quite worried about the impact this would have on their business model. They thought they might have to diversify, what a thought. And there are also some documents show that they were also excited about the business opportunities that would come from melting Arctic ice. They were doing the research. And yet, in the 1990s, the research pretty much stopped, and Exxon started pouring money into the groups engaged in denying the scientific reality that its own scientists had proven, many of the same think tanks that had been the center of denying the link between smoking and cancer. But this wasn't just funding the think tanks. Exxon and Mobil were themselves taking out full-page ads in the New York Times and other publications. Exxon is now under investigation by the Attorney General in New York State and California, and this is going to propel the movement further. You know, some people say about divestment, well, what does it matter? You know, if one school sells its stocks, somebody else is going to buy the stocks, it doesn't matter, right? It matters because in the same way that when you had the social license of tobacco companies being eroded, that created the context to tax the hell out of cigarettes, to ban smoking in restaurants, and put all kinds of new regulations on smoking. It transformed the landscape. So these students who are doing this work, whether or not they win any particular battle, the work that they're doing every time a student, a faculty member, talks about the math of divestment, right? And says these are not legitimate profits if they're based on having five times more carbon than is compatible with 2 degrees. That is creating a context where we can win policy victories, where we can win a progressive carbon tax, where we can win policies to keep the carbon in the ground. And this is starting to happen already with fracking bans, like in New York State and entire countries like France and Germany. The city of Portland, the mayor of Portland, has said that they are not going to have any new fossil fuel infrastructure. So no storage, no transit, no export facilities. And dozens of West Coast mayors and councilors have endorsed this principle of no new fossil fuel infrastructure. So we're on this road from protest to policy, and we're getting better and better at saying no to what we don't want. And that's awesome, but it is not enough, because we have to start getting better at saying yes to what we do want and articulating that just as clearly as we are articulating the no, because the no costs. It costs jobs that people badly need. It costs resources that people need to pay for services. So we need the yes. And that yes needs to not just be, you know, better than a future of climate catastrophe, right? The yes needs to be better than a present of untenable levels of inequality, of racial and gender injustice and violence, of relentless attacks on the connective tissue of our societies, our public schools, library services, infrastructure. So what does that yes feel like? What does it look like? What does it dream like? What does it fight like? I love this quote. This comes from a climate justice activist in the Bay Area named Quentin Sankofa. He works on food justice issues. Transition is inevitable. Justice is not. What he is saying here, and what we need to understand, is that we are going to transition. We are having a fight with the fossil fuel companies over timelines. They want to suck out every last bit of profit and delay and delay and delay, and those delays have massive impacts. But we are eventually going to have to respond, and there are a lot of things lining up to make that transition possible, like a renaissance in renewable energy. Prices are dropping, battery power is improving, efficiency is improving. Industry is proving how many jobs it can create if we have the right policies. We've got fantastic research out of Stanford University, led by the amazing Mark Jacobson, showing how we can get to 100% renewables for electricity in 2 decades and for our whole economy by mid-century. So people are saying, if we have to do it and we can do it, let's do it. You know, the demand to get to 100% is spreading around the world. But just because we go to renewables does not mean it is going to be just. You can do renewable energies in an extractive way. You can do it in an abusive way. You can build solar farms and wind farms on indigenous land and not share the profits and not give jobs. You can use prison labor to make solar panels, as one of the contractors for Solar City has done. You know, you can pay migrant workers abusive wages to pick organic crops, as is happening across this country. How do we do this transition in a way that is just? Now, the first thing to understand is it's not about saying climate change is so big and so urgent and time is so short that it has to trump everything else. We'll deal with that racism and sexism and poverty and all that afterwards, once we've saved the planet. That is how you piss off your allies. We live in a time of multiple overlapping crises. They are all urgent. And what we need to be fighting for and what we need to be envisioning are integrated solutions, ways to radically bring down emissions while creating huge numbers of unionized, well-paying jobs. And we need to do it in a way that is are designed to heal the wounds that date back to the founding of our countries. We can do this. So in Canada, I've been part of a process where, because the price of oil has collapsed, we have this crisis, we have to respond. And there was a meeting that I was privileged to participate in a few months ago. It was held in Toronto. There were 60 activists, leaders from different sectors, labor, climate justice, feminist movement, migration, anything you can imagine, faith, everybody, tick all the boxes. And we locked ourselves in a room for 2 days, and we did something that we very, very rarely do in progressive circles, which is not just agree on what we don't like, but actually dream about the world that we want, and to try to find the stories, the threads that connect all of these movements. There was very strong representation from Indigenous movements in the room, and one of the things that became really clear is that what we need to be doing is shifting from an economy based on endless taking and extracting as if there are no limits from the earth and also from each other's bodies, and just pushing and pushing past limits to a culture based on respecting limits and a culture based on caretaking, taking care of the planet and taking care of one another and making that central to our society. So we came up with this document. And it's really not just a list of demands. It's a story. It's an alternative story with some concrete demands about how we get there and connecting the dots between all these issues. We needed a name for this document that we came up with. And we threw some bad ideas around, and then the idea of her calling it The Leap came up. And I love the phrase leap because, of course, we need to move very, very quickly, right? And we need to get into hyperdrive, and we need movement on multiple fronts. We need Leanne Simpson and Anishinaabe, wonderful writer in Canada, talks about punctuated transformation, right? Change on multiple fronts at once. So we thought that the phrase leap really encapsulated that, right? And then we realized that 2016 is a leap year when we were going to be pushing for this. And then we started doing a little bit of research into leap years, and we realized that leap years are really interesting because in our Gregorian calendars, we do this strange thing, and we just did it, right? At the end of February, we tacked on an extra day. And we do this because our human-created system for measuring time actually does not match up with the Earth revolution around the sun. It's this very rare expression of human humility before the forces of nature, recognizing that it is actually easier to change human-created systems than it is to change the laws of nature, something that very many economists do not understand. So we called it the leap. So what's the leap? So we begin by acknowledging the original caretakers of the land, water, and air, and call for the full implementation of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People. The centerpiece of the project is energy democracy, so that as we switch from fossil fuels to renewable energy, we don't just want to switch from, you know, buying fossil fuels from Exxon to buying solar panels from Exxon. We want community control over renewable energy. We want to keep the resources in the community. We want to keep the jobs in the community. But we wanted to do more than just call for energy democracy. We also call for energy justice and energy reparations. So that's why the LEAP calls for Indigenous people and others on the front lines of industrial activity to be first to receive public support for their own clean energy projects. And there's several demands sort of that support this in the LEAP. The principle is simple: front lines first. first in line to benefit from the major new investments in the shift to renewable energy. We also call for a transformation of our agriculture system to make it far more localized, less reliant on fossil fuels, and of course, a way to capture a whole lot of carbon in the soil. We also acknowledge the role that our governments have played in wars, trade deals, and climate disasters that are collectively driving so many people from their land. And so we call for full rights for all workers, regardless of immigration status, as well as an opening of borders to many more migrants and refugees. So this, you know, what's remarkable about the document is that this has been signed by our equivalent of the AFL-CIO. It's been backed by some of the largest trade unions in Canada, and indeed the largest trade union in Canada. And one of the pieces of this vision that I'm most excited about is the way it redefines green jobs. You know, we call for all kinds of green jobs in the areas that you would, you know, imagine: green energy, efficiency, public transit, and so on. We know that we can create 8 to 10 times more jobs if we invest in those sectors and if we build more pipelines, right? But when we think of a green, you know, what a green worker is, we imagine usually a guy in a hard hat putting up solar panels, and that's true. But there are all kinds of people who are doing very low carbon work right now and are not being recognized as being part of the solution. And these are the caretakers in our economy. So we are calling for an expansion of those sectors that are already low carbon: caregiving, teaching, social work, the arts, public sector media. So all of this costs money, which is why we have to go to where the money is. We worked with a team of progressive economists who came up with a parallel document called We Can Afford to Leap, costing out where we get the money for this justice-based transition. So this is all based on the very simple principle that justice doesn't just mean that the people who got the worst deal in the old economy benefit in this transition. It also means that the people who have benefited most from destabilizing the climate have to pay their share of this bill. So it, you know, it raises a lot of stuff, and I would love for you to take a look at the whole text of the manifesto. It's at leapmanifesto.org. It's translated into 10 languages, including Cree. The reason why we called it the leap, as I said, is not just because it's a leap year, but because it, you know, it connotates the need for rapid and deep change. And we often hear that some measure, you know, some bill or other, some cap and trade bill is, you know, it's not good enough, but it's a step in the right direction. And we're supposed to be satisfied with that. Or you'll hear, oh, you know, don't be so critical of the climate deal, Naomi. It's a step in the right direction, right? But here's the thing, and this is the real reason we chose that name. When we are faced with a chasm between where we are and where we need to be in just a few years, we are not going to get there with baby steps. And people know it. We have been amazed by the response to the LEAP since we launched it in the fall. It's been signed by more than 200 organizations in our country, including, as I said, many trade unions, thousands of Canadians. We also, you know, I know that Canadian celebrity sounds like an oxymoron, but we have 10 of them, and they all signed it. Including, you know, Ellen Page and Leonard Cohen, which people were very excited about because he doesn't usually get involved in politics. And what's the most un-Canadian part of it is that people outside of Canada have actually taken notice of it. And there have been LEAP manifesto groups that have formed from Australia to Norway to the UK to the South Bronx. And on LEAP Day, there were dozens of events that took place around the world: teach-ins, discussions, sit-ins from Oslo, Belgrade, Zagreb. I spent LEAP Day in Ottawa launching a plan that I'm really excited about. We've been working with the postal workers, the postal union, for a plan to reimagine the post office as a hub for the justice-based green transition. And we launched this project with them so that the post office would be powered by electric vehicles made in Canada, that a fleet, and they wouldn't just be delivering the mail, they'd be delivering locally grown food and checking in on the elderly. There would be postal banking so that if you wanted to, you wouldn't get gouged by payday lenders. And also, if you wanted to start your own green energy co-op, you could get money for it. And there would also be people on site to give you advice and all kinds of exciting things. And it was really unprecedented for a trade union to get out front and say, we're not just going to protect things the way they are. We're not just going to say, stop the cuts, don't privatize us, don't scale us back, don't lay us off. But we see where we need to go and we want to lead. So the appetite for this kind of transformative project is enormous. And we see all of this as more signs that although establishment politicians fear change, a great many people are hungry for it. We understand that we've gone so far off course and time is so short that we now have to go for it on all fronts. At this late hour, with so much to lose and with so much to gain, now is not the time for small steps. Now is the time for boldness. Now is the time to leap. Thank you.
That was Naomi Klein on the Radical Leap. She spoke at the University of Colorado in Boulder. Naomi Klein is a leading voice for a green and sustainable planetary future. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado, celebrating 30 years of independent broadcasting. We offer our weekly program free of charge to all public and community radio stations in the United States, Canada, Australia, and beyond. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature progressive voices rarely heard in the corporate-controlled media, such as Bill McKibben, Vandana Shiva, Christian Parenti, and Lester Brown. And we have a series of programs featuring Naomi Klein. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. The Kronos Quartet performs our theme music from Pieces of Africa. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.